All right, welcome to the Hack Podcast. Today on the show, you're going to hear a huge reaction as we open up a conversation about the downsides of meditation. All that and more. Enjoy the show.
I've shot a rabbit.
A zebra.
Are we a safe distance from this?
Probably not.
I would never, ever dare say that out loud.
Hack on Triple J.
Hey, Tom Sealy here. You've heard about the benefits of meditation, but has anyone told you about the potential downsides?
There's this visual flickering and everything was constantly moving and changing and felt very shaky.
If meditation's ever freaked you out, I'd love to hear your story. Text in now, 0439 757 555. In a moment, you'll also get the latest on the Thai cave rescue. But first, to a very awkward breakup.
Hack. Boris Johnson is now the one who's leaving, quitting as foreign minister to become Theresa May's second cabinet resignation of the day.
Triple J.
One of the messiest divorces in recent history is now getting really ugly. 2 years ago, Britain shocked the world. The people of the UK voted to leave the European Union. Now, as they actually get closer to doing it, two of the three most important people in making Brexit a reality have resigned. The only one left out of that three is the Prime Minister, and she might be forced to resign very soon. So is Brexit completely doomed, or is it just the British Prime Minister who will need to exit? In a moment, you can call in and ask any questions you have about Brexit. It is very complicated. First, here's Shalala Medora explaining the story so far.
The total number of votes cast in favour of leave was 17,410,742. This means that the UK has voted to leave the European Union.
23rd of June 2016 was a huge frickin' celebration for Brexiteers. The majority of voters had elected to put an end to the 40-year marriage between Britain and the European Union.
This is what we wanted all the time. I think everyone's happy, aren't they? We're all out.
Quite happy.
Very happy, actually.
Oh, yeah. Winston Churchill would be proud of us. He'd be up there now looking down at us. Well done, Great Britain.
But 2 years on, the hangover is an absolute punish.
We have a crisis in government. Two secretaries of state have resigned.
Two of the most senior members of the UK government have resigned in the last few days. Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson and the Brexit Minister David Davis. Basically, the two people whose job it was to get the best deal for Britain after the vote. It sent the Labour opposition into a feeding frenzy.
In these vital negotiations, we need a government that is capable of governing and negotiating for Britain.
Both ministers were really pissed with the way the Prime Minister, Theresa May, was handling negotiations, saying she needs to play hardball.
The union on past practice is quite like to sit back and say, well, that's very interesting, what else have you got?
David Davis's main beef was how much the Prime Minister was willing to let the EU influence British laws.
The European Court will have a say over our borders.
While Boris Johnson said the Brexit dream was suffocating due to needless self-doubt.
After a great deal of heartache, I don't think there's anything else I can do. I will be advocating vote leave.
Boris Johnson was the face of the Leave campaign before the 2016 Brexit vote.
I would like to see a new relationship based more on trade, on cooperation, but as I say, with much less of this supranational element. So that's where I'm coming from.
His resignation puts the EU's exit plans in tatters and leaves the door open for a leadership spill against the current Prime Minister.
Boris Johnson may well be the main contender in that challenge.
That's Professor Philomena Murray from the University of Melbourne talking to ABC Radio this morning. Theresa May stepped into the leadership role after David Cameron, a so-called Remainer, lost the Brexit vote.
The British people have made a very clear decision to take a different path. And as such, I think the country requires fresh leadership to take it in this direction.
She's taken on a big old mess, though, having to guide her country through one of the biggest transitions it's ever seen.
There's a huge backlash now against May. She has lost so many members of her cabinet. So really, it's a deeply divided cabinet and a deeply divided party.
It's not just politicians who are divided on the UK's future. The people are too. weeks ago, 100,000 Remainers took to the streets of London to convince Theresa May to hold a second Brexit vote. But that's unlikely to happen.
There are many, many challenges there, and Theresa May has given the impression, unfortunately, that she's not necessarily taking these challenges seriously.
The thing is, Brexit negotiations were always going to be tricky. The UK's going into the fight with one hand tied behind its back. It needs the economic might of the EU.
The European Union is the biggest single market in the world.
John Peet from The Economist says the UK's going to have to compromise in order to get a slice of that sweet trade money.
You know, in the end, any British government is going to have to accept quite a lot of European rules.
And with a European deal on the ropes, Australia is hoping to swoop in and score a bargain of its own.
We are obviously watching the matter very closely, but we hope to be in a position to negotiate a free trade agreement with the United Kingdom after they've exited from the European Union.
So where does all of this leave Brexit? The UK has to get its shit together before March next year. That's its Brexit deadline. And John Peet reckons, for all the chest-beating, the hardline Brexiteers just don't have the political clout to get what they want from negotiations, which means Theresa May's compromise could be what they end up with.
But in the end, nobody wants Britain to leave with no deal at all, because it's bad for both the European Union and the UK.
You're listening to Hack on Triple J.
John Peet from The Economist sending that report from Shalila Medora. So the Brexit chaos, as you just heard, begs so many questions. Let's ask some of the most important ones right now. And if you have any questions about Brexit, you can call in and ask our guest. No question is too simple. It is such a bizarre, complex scenario. If you have any questions, call in now, 1-300-055-36, 1-300-055-36. Nick Rowley is right across it. He was an advisor to the British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, in the 2000s. He's now an adjunct professor in public policy at Sydney Uni. Nick, thanks so much for joining us. Is Brexit doomed, or is it just the British Prime Minister who's doomed?
Well, she may well be doomed. We'll have to see. But when it comes to Brexit, 2 years since the referendum, and nobody really knows what it means. Indeed, the very reason why it is that David Davis and Boris Johnson have decided to leave the cabinet is that they have a very different perspective on what Brexit should mean. So we haven't really even got to a point where there's a meaningful negotiation that can take place between the UK with its position to negotiate with, and the EU with its position to negotiate with. And there's not much time left. March 29th next year, if there's no deal, there's no deal.
But if there's no deal, does that necessarily put Britain in a much weaker bargaining position?
If there's no deal, I think there's potentially a whole series of really unsavoury consequences. The rules that might apply at the border in relation to the transfer of goods are unclear. The manner in which various items that are required in the European or in the British economy, the regulation of those inputs is also unclear. I'll give you one example. Pharmaceuticals, the pharmaceuticals that are used in British hospitals might well have to come from Europe. Under what terms? How are they going to be regulated? Does Britain have different regulations or the same regulations? Are they going to be taxed in any way? All these questions would be open with no deal.
Is the key problem here that Theresa May was always opposed to Brexit during the campaign? She made that clear. And then she took the job of Prime Minister, which essentially was to implement something she didn't believe in. Will her cabinet or the public ever really trust that she's driving a hard enough bargain and really wants to see this through?
Well, I think what she'd say is that she believes in the will of the British people, and she would say that the British people were asked whether or not they wanted to be part of the European Union or not, and they voted 52-48 that they did not want to be part of the EU, and it's her job as Prime Minister to get the very best deal for Britain. Over the last 2 years, she's had to do more than simply say, as she started out saying, Brexit means Brexit. Well, we don't actually know what Brexit means even today after those 2 years. I think even if she were a Prime Minister with the political gifts of Margaret Thatcher or a Tony Blair with a 100-seat majority, she would still have a very, very difficult job to do. As it is, she doesn't have standing within the Conservative Party, many people on the right of the Conservative Party who don't believe that Britain should have anything to do with a single European market, for example, are very distrustful of her because of her position previously being in favour of Britain being part of the EU. But also she's trying to square off between people in her own party who want a soft Brexit, those that want a hard Brexit, and those who want no Brexit at all. And she's on a very, very slim majority.
You're listening to Triple J's Hack Program. We're talking about Brexit. That is the voice of Nick Rowley. He was an advisor to Tony Blair for 2 years between 2004 and 2006. He's giving us the lowdown on Brexit, which is getting really, really messy on the text line. Seems that POMs think they're too good, but the reality is England need the EU more than they think. Sparrow from Ballarat, you say, what if Britain plays hardball? Surely the EU will have to bargain because all the money Britain brings to the table. What do you make of that comment? Is there some truth to that, Nick?
Well, I mean, I think that there's a lot of sort of symbolic appeal to Britain playing hardball. Britain doesn't actually make that many things anymore. I mean, we just heard Julie Bishop talking about the wonders of a potential free trade agreement with the United Kingdom. Of course, Australia has a very close ties to the United Kingdom for constitutional and historical reasons. But if you walk down a main street or through a mall and you look at the things that are being sold and the cars that are parked in the car park, very few of them come from the United Kingdom. Many of them come from Europe. Europe as an economic entity is far bigger than Britain. And Britain leaving Europe is far bigger downside for Britain than it is for Europe.
Now, you worked for Tony Blair, and he's now part of a campaign to have a second referendum on the Brexit question.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any chance they'll pull that off?
I think that that's become more probable over the last few days, simply because there is this real confusion about what Brexit actually might be. The metaphor that Tony Blair uses, which I think is pretty effective, is that when the referendum was called and people were asked whether or not they wanted to purchase this house, and they were told that it would have five bedrooms, beautiful view, lovely garden, swimming pool, luxury kitchen, all the trimmings, they thought, yeah, well, fantastic. I think we're going to go for a bit of the old Brexit action. And then that came off and they walked through the front door and there was no hot water. The kitchen was small. There were only three bedrooms and there was no backyard at all. Tony Blair would say, well, they read the advertising. They saw the thing on the smartphone. But when they actually walked through the front door, it's something quite different. They should have the ability to be asked again on this question and to potentially not buy that house.
Mm. I guess you could also equate it to buying an apartment off the plan and then realising the developers hadn't really talked to the local council properly.
Well, maybe that sadly is a condition that some people find themselves in.
On the text line, Vanessa in Lilyfield says, what does it mean if the British government doesn't get its shit together before 2019, before the deadline?
Well, I think it's going to be a complete mess. That's what happens there. The implications will be multifaceted. I think that the first ones you'd think about is there will be a lack of confidence in relation to all the trade agreements that there are between Britain and indeed all of its trading partners, but certainly the terms on which business would take place between Britain and Europe. There would therefore be a lack of confidence in the British economy. The lack of confidence in the British economy is not just something you hear about in the news or listen to in a budget speech. Those direct economic implications will have major ramifications for people, whether or not they can have jobs, how they're paid, and whether or not large industrial entities that are making things in Sunderland are able to keep making things in Sunderland, or whether they actually have to up stumps and go somewhere else where the operating environment is clearer and more stable.
Well, speaking of jobs, we'll wait and see if Theresa May still has one, in the coming weeks. Nick Rowley, thank you so much for your insight.
Pleasure, Tom.
And Nick was an advisor to Tony Blair in the 2000s. On the text line, it's bullshit that Brexit was a public referendum. People don't have any idea about the economic implications, so they should not have been the ones making such a big decision.
Hack. I meditate before I hosted the Oscars. I meditate before I go on stage. I meditate in the morning and lunchtime when I'm on a film set.
On Triple J.
Mindfulness and meditation has helped lots of people live a more focused and, in many cases, a better life. But it doesn't work for everyone. A few people texting in on this one already. Tonks in Arncliffe, Sydney says, if I meditate or try mindfulness, I open up and end up in panic mode. I've been forced to try it by doctors a couple of times and my GP finally stopped when I started shaking and couldn't speak for about 10 to 15 minutes. all about adult colouring in books, but that's about as mindful as I get. I'd love to hear from you. Have you ever gone too deep with meditation? Has it ever freaked you out? Has there ever been a downside? And how did you deal with it? Give me a call, 1300 055 36, 1300 055 36.
Hack. The Buddhist teachers were like, why are you psychologists trying to make this into a relaxation technique? You know, like, this can be a very stressful practice.
Triple J.
Now, just before we get into our segment on mindfulness, a quick update on the Thai cave rescue. The authorities held a press conference a few hours ago and announced that the divers had gone back in early. They went in about 4.5 hours ago, and they plan to bring out all four remaining players and their coach tonight. Now, overnight, there were monsoon rains, and that was, of course, increasing the risk and the urgency of this operation. But in the recent hours, the rain has backed off. The local governor said that this rescue will take longer than the other two because they had a set plan for bringing out four people, but they'll have to change that to get five out at once. And the rescue effort will involve 19 divers. Fingers crossed for that. If you're wondering what happened to Elon Musk's mini sub, it was delivered, but it looks very unlikely that it'll be used in the operation. And the other question some people are asking is, will the boys get to go to the World Cup final if they all got out? And that depends how long the doctors want to keep them in hospital.
Hack. The last four boys and their coach have now spent 17 nights in the dark, muddy cave 4 kilometres under the mountain. Eight boys have been rescued in the past 2 days and are now in hospital undergoing health checks. On Triple J.
Now, have you ever meditated? Has it always been a good experience? As the mindfulness meditation revolution has swept the Western world, we've heard so much about the benefits. As you're about to find out, it doesn't work for everyone. You can share your story in just a moment. First, here's Bart sharing his meditation misfire with reporter Joe Lauder.
We've all been hearing over the past few years how great meditation is for people. But just like penicillin, just because meditation works for some, it doesn't mean it works for everybody. Bart Paulick is a 27-year-old psychologist, and his experience with Vipassana starts out like most people's does.
It was had been on my bucket list for a really long time, you know, most about 10 years, because I just heard these reports of people having these amazing experiences.
Vipassana is a type of meditation, and on these retreats, you sit totally still, upright, in total silence, and you can't speak for 10 days. Yeah, 10 days.
So at the start of the retreat, I was having lots of pain, lots of physical pain, and boredom and frustration at myself because I was having trouble focusing and concentrating. And so it was very kind of unpleasant but mundane. But starting halfway through the third day, I became so concentrated on focusing on the breath that it actually became really, really intensely blissful in a way that actually kind of blew me away and I wasn't expecting. And that was the point at which it started to change.
This is where Bart's story deviates from most of the Vipassana stories I've heard before.
So I was experiencing an odd flickering. So I'd look at something and it would seem to jump to the left and right. And what really turned for me was I woke up about 2 a.m. about the seventh night of the retreat. Was my first ever experience of a panic attack. That's because there's this visual flickering and my body sensations felt very different and everything was constantly moving and changing and felt very shaky. And that was the point that things started to get, you know, pretty scary. It was really distressing because I didn't know what was going on and I didn't know if it would be permanent or not.
But it wasn't just these physical problems. Bart also said he felt like his sense of self, who he was, started to change.
Also, I was experiencing something that, from a clinical point of view, might be called depersonalization, but in something like Buddhist philosophy might be called the experience of no self, as if I was like an invisible man or something. Like there wasn't quite... you know, when people were looking at me directly at work, it was quite an odd experience because I didn't necessarily have a sense of there was someone there to be looked at.
So firstly, he reached out for help with a meditation retreat.
The message I got was that nothing bad can ever happen with meditation. I also spoke to the teacher several times and the instruction was always keep going, keep doing the meditation technique and actually practice harder and practice more diligently.
Did you feel at any point like that you... wanted to get out of there, like you felt like you shouldn't be there?
Yeah, definitely. There was several times during the retreat where I did feel the urge to leave, but it was very strongly discouraged. Yeah. And it was also challenging practically because I was away from home in a different state and I had my flights booked.
It's not actually that surprising, knowing what we know about how meditation affects the brain, about some of the more undesirable side effects it can also have. This is Willoughby Britton. I'm an assistant professor of psychiatry and human behavior at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island.
Willoughby's described herself to me as the ground zero for meditators in crisis, which says a lot, really. She's recently done research into the challenges that people have meditating, the stuff you don't hear influencers banging on about. But before that, she started meditating herself at 20 to deal with anxiety after the loss of a friend.
So I had many, many decades of practice and had my own like range of experiences. And then when I was doing my clinical psychology residency, I was working at an inpatient psychiatric hospital, and there were two meditators that came off retreat who were psychotic. And that was the first time that I saw, you know, something much more serious.
Willoughby's done a huge study on the pitfalls of meditating, mostly experiences people have when they go really deep in retreats or prolonged meditating. In the study, she came up with 59 categories of challenges that meditators might run into.
So there's like perceptual changes, changes in emotions and sense of self, somatic changes, social changes, perceptual hypersensitivities, lots of fear, anxiety, paranoia, things on that kind of spectrum. So emotional sort of intensity, and then also the opposite. We also saw loss of all emotions or emotional blunting.
Meditation has been around for centuries, and these kind of dark experiences aren't new, especially because you're playing with your mind and your way of perceiving the world. Even the Beatles song Dear Prudence is about their time in India when someone locked herself in a room meditating for days on end. However, there's a real meditation and mindfulness revolution going on at the moment. And as Willoughby points out, talking about the heavy stuff isn't going to get you on the New York Times bestseller list.
These negative effects are well documented in Buddhist texts, so it's not like anyone's surprised, especially the Buddhist teachers. I mean, everyone knows that these things exist, but I think that in terms of just marketing and businesses, you know, one of the teachers actually told me, like, it's not good advertising to talk about these side effects.
Willoughby runs an online support group for people who've struggled with their experiences meditating and feel like they've failed something that most people love.
Yeah, I mean, I get probably 3 calls a week from a meditator in crisis, and I've talked to more than 500 of them over the years. So that tells me that they're not getting the support they need from the place where they learn to meditate.
Now Willoughby's developed a training program for meditation teachers to help them deal with meditators who are having a bad trip, so to speak.
I'm hoping that we can just train the teachers that are teaching these practices to be able to provide the support sort of in-house rather than having it triaged out to me, because I honestly can't handle the volume. I've been hearing that people have been waiting for this training for more than a decade.
Yeah, right, so there hasn't been much of a pushback?
I mean, I think that the pushback comes from the fact that mindfulness is a multi-billion dollar industry and, you know, this isn't good news for business, but I don't think there's any way around it. I think we just have to move forward in a responsible way.
If you're listening to this and you're questioning ever doing meditation, Willoughby doesn't want to turn you off it. She just wants people to talk more about both sides of it. It's also something Bart wants out of his experience.
I just hope that if anyone else has had any challenges in meditation or on retreat, that they know they're not alone and this is something that can happen and other people do go through. I'd also like to see more research and more funding for research in this space, especially that meditation mindfulness is becoming so popular. And I guess the last thing is just a more of an open discussion, particularly among teachers.
Hack Triple J.
That's Bard telling his story to Joe Lauder on the text line. What type of moron goes from no meditation to a 10-day retreat? Loads of texts coming in on this one. I'm a medical specialist who does Vipassana. This is a complex practice which needs support. People need to have some basic grounding in meditation before embarking on this technique and have a proper expert teacher. Let's go to someone in the sector. Paul... Majewski is a meditation teacher. He's also the Vice President of Meditation Australia, which is an organisation that represents meditation teachers. Paul, thanks for joining us. Are you at all surprised to hear about people having negative experiences with meditation?
No, not at all, Tom. It's quite common, as Willoughby Britton said in your piece before.
Right, okay. So, I mean, how many people have bad reactions to meditation compared to good?
I'd say it's still a minority, but it is more common when people are undertaking intensive practice, such as the 10-day silent retreats.
Right, okay. So would you recommend people do a lot of meditation leading up to something like that?
I certainly would. I think you're taking a big risk by, jumping in at the deep end with a 10-day silent retreat. So people will be under quite a lot of psychological pressure in an environment like that. A lot of it is self-created, of course, people who are bringing certain expectations to the practice and putting themselves under a lot of pressure to somehow get it right.
Mm. Okay. Josh has joined us on the phone. Josh, you did a Vipassana retreat. Did you do any meditation leading up to it?
I have meditated on and off for quite a long time, actually, but I dabbled and I found it really difficult to be disciplined. So that's what led me to a Vipassana retreat, is because I had no option but to meditate for around 12 hours a day.
And were there any negative consequences for you?
No, the consequences were all positive for me, fortunately, but I could see how it is quite intense and can bring up quite a lot of things for people. For me, it offered a lot of perspective, because in everyday life, my mind seems to race at a million miles an hour. So when I got to slow that down, I could see things a lot more clearly.
And is it now something you do every day?
Almost every day. I try and incorporate it into my everyday actions. So I try and become meditative more than set time aside to meditate, though I think that's very important as well.
Yeah, all right. Thanks so much for joining us, Josh.
That's okay. Thank you for having me on.
My pleasure. Let's get a neuroscience perspective on meditation. Dr. Scott Kolb is a neuroscientist. Scott, what's meditation actually doing to the brain?
So what we know is that when you're meditating, you're actually focusing your mind quite a lot. So you can think of it as like a very, very strongly focused attention. And then I guess there are lots of different meditative practices. Just to give a couple of examples, one might be what they call focused attention, where you might be staring at a candle and you do that for an extended period of time. Now, we know that that leads to enhanced activity in areas of the brain that are involved in attention and attending to things very strongly. And people who have dedicated a lot of time to this practice, we know have enduring effects in the brain, whereby their attention centers in the brain are much more active than normal people. Then there are the other types of meditation, which you've alluded to, Vipassana and mindfulness, which are sort of more open. We call them open monitoring. So you're sort of monitoring the environment and trying not to concentrate on anything in particular. Again, we see that in people's brains, that actually is related to more activity in areas that we know are related to attention. So it's still attention, but you're attending to something quite different. And then the other thing I wanted to raise is the idea of mind wandering, and I think your last caller brought that up a little bit, that a lot of the practices around meditation stop your mind from just wandering around. And we know that mind wandering is related to the activity in certain areas of your brain called the default mode network. And we know that people who have undergone a lot of meditation practice actually have reduced activity in these parts of the mind-wandering brain. So definitely there
is... So is that a bad thing or a good thing?
Well, there is actually some research that links mind-wandering with unhappiness. Now, you could kind of... So this mind-wandering, these areas of the brain are also involved in your autobiographical memory, so your memory of your life, and also your forward planning about things you're going to do in the future. So
Scott, I'll just go back to our other guest there, because I want to pick up on what you just said. Thanks so much for joining us there. Paul, in your practice, I mean, are you aware of this stuff? And do you think you're doing a good enough job, and, you know, you're representing the industry, a good enough job to tell people about the potential downsides and the, you know, ramifications of that?
I think that there's such a variety of different teachers and different practices that there is a certain responsibility that anyone needs to take going into that situation to make sure that the teacher that they have is sufficiently experienced and qualified and able to offer a good level of support, particularly if a person is somewhat vulnerable. You know,
so buyer beware, essentially?
Well, there is an aspect of that. I think it's a two-way street.
Hack on Triple J.
All right, that's all we have time for on the radio show. But for you podcast listeners, I want to read you some more of the text because there was actually a huge reaction to that segment on meditation. Casey from Moorabbark says, I teach meditation weekly. One of the most important things as a teacher is not to push people too deep too quickly. Another listener, you say, altered states and self-awareness are not always going to make us happy. They are learning tools, not a holiday. Another listener, you say, I meditated last week for around 30 minutes and following it, I felt extremely disconnected and disassociated for the remainder of the day. I had to drive later that day and felt extremely anxious as I almost felt as though I was dreaming, not in a good way, and couldn't concentrate at all. And someone says, meditation's fully boring and really expensive. I guess that might be the final word, but I think the most important final word is probably what the meditation teacher said at the end of the radio show, which is you want to make sure that you're with a teacher that has lots of experience. All right, that's all we've got time for, even on the podcast. I'll catch you tomorrow.